2 Samuel chapter 7, we read in verse 1, King David was settled in his palace, and the Lord had given him rest from all of his enemies around him. So King David was the sort of man that didn't like to rest. He's a very active man, and he spent the majority of his life sleeping on the hills in Israel, in caves, stone, stuff like that. And yet here we see him in a very cush palace, nice bed. He's not used to this. You see people that return from war sleeping on the ground. They can't get used to modern life. And here's David. He's in a palace. What is this? And we read that the Lord had given him rest from all of his enemies. He spent the majority of his life fighting enemies of all kinds, of all stripes. You know, the men from Saul, the Ammonites, Ishbosheth, all the other guys in Israel, the civil war, Philistines. I mean, he's constantly fighting, and now he's in a palace, big screen TV, no enemies, security all over the place. David says to Nathan, the prophet, he says, here I am, living in a house of cedar. Look at this, palace, cedar, very, very expensive wood. And he's just looking around at the grandeur, the grandiose palace in which he's living, while the ark of God remains in a tent. You see the parallel? Here I am in a palace, and over there we got a Coleman tent for God's ark. I mean, this thing was ragged at this point. It's 400 years old. They didn't last that long. And this was it. This was the tent, as we studied last week. And in the tent, we saw that it was filled with all sorts of ornate, sacred objects and people. The high priest, the bread, different sacrifices, the menorah, and principally the Ark of the Covenant. This was essentially a box of legal evidence that was there to show the guilt of the people. And every year, once a year, one man would enter into the Holy of Holies to spray and spread the blood of an innocent animal over this box of legal evidence that showed the guilt of the people. And this was a way of showing to a mostly illiterate group of people how God was going to pay for sin. The blood of an innocent substitute was going to cover the guilt and the sin of the people. So this entire thing is a sacred picture of something that was coming in the future through the person of Jesus Christ. And David is just absolutely nauseated at the thought that here he's sitting in complete avarice and wealth, and he's looking over in God's ark, which he fought so hard to get back into the city of Jerusalem. He's sitting there out in the middle of nowhere. Well, Nathan the prophet replied to David. He could kind of see where this is all going. Whatever you've got in mind, and he didn't say anything, but whatever you got in mind, David, go ahead and do it, for the Lord is clearly with you. Nathan apparently was like, whatever you do turns to gold. So I'm sure God is just going to get behind this. But, that night, the word of the Lord came to Nathan. And God said to Nathan, I want you to go and tell these things to my servant David. Are you the one to build me a house in which to dwell? So David, all of a sudden, you're the one who's going to be the builder for God. Like, I need a house, and if I needed a house, would I turn to you to be the one who builds it? I have not dwelt in a house from the day I brought the Israelites up out of Egypt to this very day. Do you remember my origin story? Well, of course, it's eternity, but when he appears to Moses, it's in a burning bush. No holy place, space, nothing like that. And I never had a house. I had a tent, and I like my tent. I've been moving from place to place within a tent as my dwelling. I like my mobile home, and I don't want you to take it away from me. That's what he's saying. This is totally bizarre if you are a student of world religion. In world religion, maybe you've taken a course at university, Mircea Eliade, Rudolf Otto. You study that in world religion, they are obsessed with sacred spaces and places. That whenever you can come into a specific place and find that this is the holy place, we've got to build this up. and it's got to look good for God too. I mean, it's got to look really good, and it's got to be built up and around, and it only stays here because this is the holy place. Now, out there, that's where the pagans live, but in here, this is where the holy people are. And so Sunday saint, Monday ain't, this is where you come to get in with God, and this is the place that you go. And this is really universal throughout world religion. When human beings speculate and look out toward God, they wonder, what is God like? Oh, he's probably like us. He probably would want a house, a sacred space. And God is like, no, actually, I like to move from place to place. This whole idea that you would pick up the tent, and they would, and you'd pick up the ark, and they did, and you would move it. Whoa, weird. I mean, everywhere in world religion, you know, whether it's a church or a synagogue, a mosque, those are just the Western religions, the Eastern religions, same thing. And I'm not here to pick on anybody, I'm here to pick on everybody. This is everybody in world religion. This is the way it is, the sanctuary, the holy place, the holy space. And in biblical religion, we have the original idea that God is the one who moves and you move with him. This, of course, is a picture of Jesus Christ. You say, how did you make that leap? Well, I didn't. The Apostle John did in John, the first chapter, verse 14, where he said that Jesus came and tabernacled, he dwelt among us. This whole picture of a tabernacle where God dwells and it moves and you follow him, Leviticus is at 26:12, where God says, I want to walk among my people. That became very literal in the person of Jesus, where God took on a human body, an additional nature, a human nature, and walked among his people. This is, you don't find this in any other religion. And so this whole idea that we got to make something very static, stationary, inert, doesn't move, a building. God is very, very reluctant to this. He's like, that's just not my deal. The whole earth is mine and everything in it. Psalm 24, the earth is my footstool. Isaiah 66, you want to build me a house? Well, wherever I have moved with all the Israelites, did I ever say to any of their rulers whom I commanded to shepherd my people, why have you not built me a house of cedar? Did I ask for this? You know, you're going to go put me in the home. I didn't say that I wanted to be there. David, I took you from the pasture. You remember where I found you? You were a kid. You were a shepherd chasing the sheep and the goats out in the hills of Israel. And I found you, and I took you out of the pasture. I appointed you ruler over my people Israel. I have been with you ever since or wherever you have gone, and I have cut off all your enemies from before you. Now I will make your name great like the names of the greatest men on earth. I did this for you. And I will provide a place for my people Israel, and I will plant them so that they can have a home of their own and no longer be disturbed. Wicked people won't oppress them anymore as they did at the beginning and have done ever since the time I appointed leaders over Israel. I will also give you rest from all of your enemies. And this is where it gets really, really good. This is a point in the biblical narrative that serves as somewhat of an anchor that transfixes much of what we read throughout the rest of the Hebrew Bible and certainly the New Testament. So much so that if you don't understand this, you don't understand the Old Testament as you should, and certainly much of the New Testament makes no sense to you whatsoever. This is what is referred to as the Davidic covenant. Davidic meaning David, and a covenant meaning a contract or an agreement between two parties. God is entering into a covenant or a contract with David, so this is called the Davidic covenant. This is 197 Hebrew words that God is speaking in a straight monologue. This is the most that he's spoken since the time of Moses in the Bible. So this is standing out as something as a statue that we need to learn and understand if we're going to understand the flow and the movement of the biblical narrative. This is incredibly important, in other words. With me? One person nodded, so I'm going to keep going. The Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. Do you see the play on words here? Did you see it? God, we need to build a house for you. And God says, ditto. I'm going to build a house for you. No, I'm going to build a house for you. No, I'm going to build a house for you. Well, I'm going to build a house that's a temple. And God's like, oh, no, 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 no. I'm going to build you like a house, like a dynasty, something that's going to be a kingdom. Like I've been rereading the Game of Thrones when they say the house of Lannister, you know, the house of Stark and the house of whoever. They don't mean the house. They mean the family. And God is saying to David, we're going to build a house for you. And this is going to be a kingdom. And he says, I will raise up your zerah, seed, literally, seed. It's kind of a graphic term. Literally, your seed is going to be raised up. Your offspring, yeah, your descendants, but this is in the singular. But it says that it's going to go on forever. So immediately we're seeing tension. And you might say, why are we even pointing to this word, offspring? Because this is the anticipation of what we've been reading in the Hebrew Bible up until this point. And I mean from page one. We read in Genesis 3:15, where the fall, the great moral fall for the first humans, has happened minutes prior. And God comes on the scene, not fumbling around thinking of a plan. Instead, right away, God is on target and says, I know a plan, and he says to the serpent, to Satan, I will cause hostility between you, Satan, and the woman, between your zerah, seed, and her zerah, seed. He will strike you on the head, and you will strike his heel. Oh, whoa, 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 whoa. There's two people on earth. Who's the he? Well, it ain't Eve. She's not the one. Her seed. What's so interesting is that the Hebrews were not a, you know, matrilineal culture. They were a patrilineal culture. They went through the male line. X was the father of Y, and Y was the father of Z, and Z was the father of A. They didn't go through the mother, but here, it's the seed of a woman, not a man. Almost as if, I don't know, I don't want to push it too far, but this figure, whoever he is not going to come from the product of a man, but only from the product of a woman. A virginal conception. Then we flash forward to the time of Abraham and we pick up on this idea of seed. God said to Abraham, I will confirm my covenant or contract with you. This is the everlasting covenant. I will always be your God and the God of your zerah, your seed after you, your offspring, your descendants. Then we flash forward to Genesis 22:18. God told Abraham, through your zerah, your seed, all the nations on the earth will be blessed, all because you have obeyed me. This brings us to the Davidic covenant. God came in powerfully through Abraham and said, I'm going to bless all people on earth through you. So God chooses a people not to suppress the world and the other nations, but to bless the world and the other nations. And he does this principally through Jesus. Jesus is the one who comes out of Israel, who comes out of the line of David. Why is it that when we open up our Bibles in Matthew, the very beginning of our New Testament, the very first verse is that this is the genealogy of Jesus, son of Abraham, son of David? Why is it that when the blind man is crying out in Luke, son of David, have mercy on me, son of David, what did that mean? It meant he is the Messiah. He's recognizing Jesus as such. He is the Christ, the Messiah. Through the line of Abraham, but also through the line of David, the Davidic covenant. It's got to be one of David's heirs. Well, that narrows it right down to a pinpoint to be able to identify the Messiah. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father and he will be my son. When he does wrong, what? I thought we were talking about Jesus here. When he does wrong, I will punish him with a rod, what? Wielded by men with floggings inflicted by human hands. What's going on with that? Jesus was punished for doing wrong? Okay, remember, he's talking about a dynasty. Your descendant, Abraham's descendant, was Isaac, but then Jacob, and then all the 12 tribes, and they went on their way. So immediately, this is going to be fulfilled in David's son, Solomon, who builds the temple. However, it doesn't finish with Solomon. Well, how do you know that? We know that because Solomon didn't live forever. Obviously, he didn't live forever. So initially, partially, this is going to be fulfilled in Solomon, but this is going to be a forever agreement. You will always have someone on the throne. So I'm going to discipline your descendants. They're going to do wrong. I like how he doesn't say if they do wrong. It's when they do wrong. And when this occurs, he says, my love will never be taken away from him as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. To see someone like Saul, and yet Saul blew it so poorly and so badly that his sons were killed. And as a consequence, we see that Saul's line went to complete destruction. And yet we're seeing in this promise here that's never going to happen. Never. There's always going to be someone in your descendants forever. I'm going to discipline them. I'm going to punish them. And if you've read the Old Testament at all, the history of the nation of Israel is precisely this, that what we have is a continual thirst for a righteous king to be on the throne, but we never find one. But my love will never be taken away from him. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. Forever, forever, forever. He says it three times. Psalm 89, some commentary on this passage. One of the ways that we know we're getting our interpretation correct is by looking at other parts of the Bible. You know, I could write a commentary on 2 Samuel, but wouldn't it be better if we had an inspired author write the commentary for us? Yes, the Bible is its best interpreter. We read in verse 28 of Psalm 89, I will love David and be kind to him forever. This is centuries after this occurred. He's saying, I'm still with this covenant. My covenant with David will never end. I will preserve an heir for him. His throne will be an endless throne as the days of heaven. But if his descendants forsake my instructions, then I will punish their sin with the rod and their disobedience with beating. This is the history of Israel. This is the exiles. This is when the Assyrians come in. It's when the Babylonians come in. They keep getting kicked out of their land, but they always get back in. I will never revoke my love from David. I will never stop loving David nor fail to keep my promise to him. No, I will not break my covenant. I will not take back a single word I said. I have sworn an oath to David, and in my holiness I cannot lie. His dynasty will go on forever. His kingdom, how can I put this? His kingdom will endure as the sun. You know the sun? You know the sun, how it endures? Like you wake up every day and you're like, you again, you know? Like it's just there and it's going to be there. It's just going to keep on going every day. His kingdom is going to be like the sun. You would have a better chance of taking down the Davidic covenant than you would if the sun just exploded out of nowhere. How about this? It will be as eternal as the moon. That's not going anywhere anytime soon. The moon? Yeah, my faithful witness in the sky. David's covenant, it's going to go away. How do you know it's going to go away? Well, the moon went away. That's how we know. That's how serious this is. But now, he writes in verse 38, you have rejected him and casted him off. So there was a specific situation in which this occurred where the king at the time that Psalm 89 was written was cast off and was being disciplined by God. But before that, the prologue is, I am never going to leave the line of David ever. I mean, what if you want stronger language, I don't know what you would add. It's the same as the sun existing, the moon. By my own character, I cannot lie. It'll be forever, period, end of story, end of discussion. So that is the Davidic covenant. Now we got some questions to consider. Number one, how is it that David's dynasty can last forever? Well, it seems to me that if we were reading this at the time that it was written, we would have one of two options, seems to me. Option A is there will be an eternal succession of David's descendants, meaning David would have a son, Solomon, and then he would rule so many years and then he would die. And then Solomon would have a son and he would rule so many years and then he would die. And then another son would reign. And there would always be a king on the throne. And he would die, but another one would replace him. And just on and on and on, century after century, millennia after millennia. That's how you could get the Davidic line to go on for eternity. Or, option B, one of David's descendants would rule eternally. Now, we already know that option A cannot be the case because you cannot have a succession of kings go on forever. So that leaves us with option B. One of David's descendants would eventually rule and reign the planet Earth forever. Number two, why then isn't a Davidic king on the throne today? I face eastward and I look at Israel. I turn on the news. I don't see a king. I don't see a throne. I don't see a temple. I see Israel, but there hasn't been a king on the throne in Israel for two millennia. It's quite a gap, wouldn't you say? But God says here forever, forever, and forever. Yeah, they're going to sin and I'm going to punish them. I'm going to kick them out of their land. But I'm never going to revoke my love. I'm always going to bring them back to the land. And there's always going to be a king. I'm never going to abandon you. It won't be like Saul. You won't be cut off. So how then can we have the throne sitting empty for 2,000 years? Well, what we see in our Hebrew Bible is that David's sons, the descendants of David, starting with Solomon and really starting with David himself, weren't righteous enough to follow God. So we see just repeatedly the kings after David, 40 or so kings, just keep getting, you know, assassinated, invaded, killed, wiped out. There's only three or four that are any good, and even they aren't that good. But following this, God would temporarily pull them out of power. But here's the key adverb here. Temporarily. He would pull them out of power, but then he would get them back in. And what we're seeing currently today is a 2,000-year temporary hiatus of the Davidic covenant, where we don't have a king on the throne. Or do we? This prophecy hasn't been fulfilled, but we're saying it hasn't been fulfilled yet. Hasn't been fulfilled yet. This leads us to our third question. Is this a messianic prediction? Answer, oh yeah. Because what we're seeing here is a king who is in the line of David who will occupy that throne for eternity. Who could that be? Oh, the later prophets, they just can't help but pick up on this motif. That's why you read Ezekiel 37. You know, it's about the end of history. I'm quoting this faithfully, but read it for yourself. Ezekiel 37. Clearly, you're like, this hasn't happened yet. They will never again pollute themselves with their idols and vile images and rebellion. For I will save them from their sinful apostasy. I will cleanse them. Then they will truly be my people, and I will be their God. Has that happened in Israel yet? Ever? 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 Never. It's never happened. They've never been a sinless nation. That's never happened. But it will happen in the future. My servant David will be their king. And they will have only one shepherd. They will obey my regulations and be careful to keep my decrees. They will live in the land I gave my servant Jacob, the land where their ancestors lived. They and their children and their grandchildren after them will live there forever, generation after generation. Has this happened yet? No, that hasn't happened yet. And my servant David will be their prince forever. What is Ezekiel talking about here? Didn't he know in the 6th century BC that David had been dead for 500 years. It's David's descendant, the descendant of David, who will be the ultimate king, the perfect righteous king, will rule over Israel. I can't resist. I can't. Jeremiah 23. The time is coming, says the Lord, when I will raise up a righteous descendant from King David's line. He will be a king who rules with wisdom. He'll do what is right and just, blah, blah, blah. And this will be his name. Check this out. We're going to call him the Lord, Yahweh, L-O-R-D, all caps, Y-H-W-H, the Tetragrammaton, the holy name for God. We're going to call this guy in the line of David, human born from David's descendancy. We're going to call him Yahweh, our righteousness. Oh, that is just too powerful right there. And this, again, is at the end of history. This has not happened yet. Yahweh, we're going to call a man Yahweh. Any Israelite worth their salt, anyone who is observant at all, to call a man Yahweh, oh, that would just make you cringe. God cannot be a man. That's not what we're reading here. God can do anything he pleases. There's nothing logically impossible about God taking on a human nature. And that's precisely what we see here. Well, what are we seeing from this chapter? Number one, God's gift was relational. It was spiritual, not material. David wanted to build God this awesome, ornate, beautiful, rich house. God's like, I'm actually going to give you something even better. Number two, God's gift was greater than David could ever imagine. He couldn't believe that through me, there's going to be somebody who's going to pay for the sins of the entire world, that's going to be the most influential person who ever lived, and will bring hundreds of millions, if not billions, of non-Jewish people to worship the God of Israel, Jesus. And principally speaking, we're seeing a very important lesson on which we should ponder, which is that God has no needs. David is learning from all this that when he tries to give God a house, God comes back and just, no. What I'm going to give to you is something infinitely better. So when David was giving his offering to God, he thought this was something really special. I mean, really special. You know, a temple, an incredible temple, and God's just like, I don't need it. I don't want it. It's not my idea, but I like your heart. And so I'm actually going to give you a temple instead, a house instead. So what is it that we can learn from all this? This picture of a God who is self-existent, who has no needs. As the older theologians used to say, he has the property or the attribute of a seity. In Latin, a means from, and se means self. How does God exist? He exists from himself. He has no needs. He doesn't need anyone in this room to do anything. He doesn't need any of our sacrifices. He needs none of it. He needs none of our hard work, our moral effort, our prayers. He has no needs. He existed eternally without us, was doing just fine. He exists now. He's still perfectly satisfied in the persons of the Trinity. He does not need us at all. So when we try and tell God, I have a gift for you, God immediately, his knee-jerk reaction is, I've got everything. He's like, what do you get for the God who has everything? You can give him nothing. Oh, this is totally unique in world religion as well. You look at world religion, it's all about how we got to feed the gods. I mean, this can get pretty carnal. We put out the sacrifices like cookies for Santa, and they're going to make them feast. Now you're happy. We're going to, you know, make the gods feel good. You're going to give us a good sea voyage, will you? I mean, more sacrifices, okay. So we constantly need to feed the gods, but in biblical faith, God's like, if I wanted a sacrifice, Psalm 50, I would look to the cattle on 1,000 hills, which I created. I wouldn't go to you for it. Paul says, God is not served by human hands as though he needed anything. God is self-existent. That's what we're seeing here. We don't react that well to this. You know, in one sense, it sounds nice that God doesn't need anything from us. In another, psychologically, I guess, it's hard to relate to a God like this because we look around at our world and we see needy people all over the place, deeply broken people like you, like me. We're needy. That's the word. That's what we call it, needy. And then we are bumping into each other, trying to relate to each other, broken selves, trying to fix other broken, fractured people. And I mean, this is in all facets of life, financially, you know, relationally, medically. We are all one diagnosis away from being just completely inept, unable to care for anybody. We are all one financial crisis away from being completely impoverished and needy. Yeah, we live under the veneer of this illusion that, yeah, we've got everything together. No, you do not. There is something hurtling at you right now, 100 miles an hour, that you can't see. We are deeply, deeply needy. So when we come to God, this is our impression where we actually are encountering the God who has no needs, but we start to think about him projecting a neediness onto God. You say, no, I don't. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. People who say, you know, why is it that God needs me to pray to him? You know, why is it that God needs me to read the Bible? Why does he need me to do that? Why does God need my money? Doesn't God have enough money of his own? He needs mine? How about this? You start to progress in your Christian life, and all of a sudden you get the sense that God is calling on you to put something into his hands, to give something over to him. Why would he take that from me? Why would God take that away? Oh, what is this? This is protection. This is defensiveness. We're thinking that God is trying to take and take and take some more. Oh, man, that's a problem, viewing God as a taker. What about trying to bargain with God, trying to negotiate with God? Yeah, typically this comes out in Christian circles, at least in the Western world, in terms of fairness. You know that idea of fairness? Fairness works really well with other people that are broken and fallen and sinful. Like with people, we need justice. With people, we need fairness. We should aim for that as best as we can. If we turn to God and we say, God, I want fairness. I want justice. I want what I deserve. If you ever say that to God, I pray that you duck and cover under your desk with your hands over your head to say to the Almighty God, I want justice. Because if you do so, what you are communicating to God is that you want to pay for every single moral violation in thought, word, and deed that you have ever committed in your entire life. We don't want justice. We don't want fairness with God. That is the last thing that we want with God. What we want from God is mercy. That's what we want. And if you're here and you know Christ, you are living under mercy. That's what you have. Many people say, well, this isn't fair. You know, other people are getting better off than I am. So what do you want? You want fairness? You want justice? Never, never, never ask for God to give you what you deserve. So, in a sense, we're showing up before God, bargaining. If you give me this, then I'll give you that. God's like, you're like a criminal on death row trying to argue with the judge. Hey, you know, I got a piece of, you know, green beans here I can trade you. Can you postpone a little bit? We got nothing to offer. We got nothing to negotiate with here. It's like going to the rental company and you return the car and you're like, you're welcome. You know, he's like, I gave you that car. I think I own that thing. That's way too nice for you to drive. You know, we return something that belonged to them in the first place. We've got nothing to negotiate with. You can't bargain with God. You can't negotiate this. What about the idea of people just working themselves to death, you know, through moral performance? This is all in our minds. I hope you know that. In your mind, you're sitting there thinking to yourself, I'm not good enough. I don't compare. I'm not like other people. I need to do better. I'm not as good. I need to perform over and over and over, day after day, year after year. And you run yourself completely ragged with moral effort and performance. What is this? Well, who's this for? It's not for God. God doesn't need any of this. God doesn't want it. You know what God calls it in Isaiah 64? He calls it filthy rags. Bloody tampons. That's what it is. Menstrual rags. He says, your good deeds before me. When I see that, it's menstrual rags. Paul calls all of the good works he ever did, he calls it skubalon, dung. I won't even get into the literal translation of that word. So we come to God with our moral performance and we're like, here, God, here's what I have for you. Menstrual rags and dung. And God looks at that and says, is this supposed to impress me at all? You don't relate to a God like that. Let's be honest, coming before God with our good deeds, we don't even do that well compared to other broken people. Most of our insecurity is comparing ourselves to others with whom we do not compare. And now we're trying to turn that over toward God and saying, I'm just going to impress you so much with how great I am. Oh, no wonder we're exhausted. You know, why am I feeling so worn out, so tired, so beat up all the time, so guilty? So what a terrible way to live your life. Sounds awful. Walk around feeling guilty and terrible all the time, filled with shame, comparing yourself to other people, performing, putting on a mask all the time. Sounds awful. A terrible way to live. None of this is the way that God wants us to relate to Him. And yet, in our bankruptcy, we come to God trying to say we've got a reservoir of something. We got something to give you. I hate it. I want to be able to show that I'm something. And God says, if you just let go of that, you'll discover that you are someone. You're someone because I love you. You're someone because I died for you. You're someone that I've been looking at from all of eternity, waiting for you to turn to me. Isn't that so much better than our posturing and our moral effort, our little minuscule accomplishments that we have, these little things that we do? Wouldn't it be nice if we could just drop all of that filth and turn to God on His basis as a giver, as somebody? Well, what would that look like? For one, that would look like trusting that God doesn't want to take anything from your life that's worth anything. Whoa, God, you're asking me to give this up. Why would God want that? God doesn't want whatever that is, you know what I mean? You're asking me to give this up. I don't know what it is in your life. Maybe God is putting something on your heart that He's saying, I'd like you to give this to me. Hand this over to me. God doesn't want that because it's worth anything. He doesn't want to take that out of your hand because it matters. He's taking it away because it's beneficial for you. That's how God works as a self-existent being. We need to focus on God's promises, not on what we deserve. Now, that's different. That's different. I've been going back and studying William R. Newell's thoughts about grace, where repeatedly this theologian keeps saying over and over and over, we can't come to God demanding that He bless our lives. Can't do that. Through hard work, through religious rituals, through actions, through even good spiritual things. You don't show up to God like that. But you can show up to God anticipating that He's going to bless your life by something other than yourself. Someone other than yourself. Jesus Christ. Your brother and God, your Father. The one who's going to bless you. Why? Just because He loves you. That's why. Not because you earned it. Not because you jumped through the hoop enough times. Not because you had some kind of an act that you put together where you perform. He just wants to give to you. Why? Just because He loves you. That's why. That's the great secret. Even on your worst day, showing up before God and just saying, I don't deserve it, but I'm trusting and I'm looking forward to You blessing me anyways. Finally, accepting and appreciating the God, or what God, has already given to you. How about looking at the incredible life he's given to you already. The things in your life, I was sitting there today in prayer, just trying to get into some gratitude, sitting there, thank you for my car that runs. Thank you for this great group of people I get to work with. Thank you for my wife. Thank you for, and it just started to build and build and build. Man, my soul just lifted, felt so good to just appreciate the many, many gifts that God has given. And for you sitting here tonight who don't know Jesus Christ, to accept what he's given you, the way the Bible refers to Jesus as the gift of God. He is the gift, the gift. And I've talked to some people, they've said, well, yeah, I was baptized and stuff, right? I've been to church and, you know, whatever. My dad was a reverend, a pastor, or whatever. Okay, that's your dad. That's the location. That's the holy space. There it is. Good, great. Have you ever received the gift of Christ? What do you mean? I mean, have you ever asked God, the self-existent being, who just wants to give? He just wants to give and give and give and give. And he gave his son to the entire world so that whosoever believes in him will not die, but will have eternal life. Have you ever personally made the choice to receive that? If you can't remember a time where you received Christ and his forgiveness into your heart, there's a good chance you never did. You may have been to church. You may have been around Christians. That doesn't matter. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about receiving from God. God has a gift for you here tonight. All of this, the picture of what the temple was, what David was all about, the son of David, Jesus, what that's all about, I would be remiss if you left here tonight and you didn't hear the message that you need to come to Christ tonight. Quit putting this off and just do it. Have the courage to open up your heart and say, God, if you're really that giving, if you're really that loving and you want to give out to me, I want it. I'm done with the performance. I'm done with the bargaining, the negotiating, the deserving attitude. And I just want to receive what Christ did for me. And let me tell you, if you do that, tonight will be the best, most important night of your life.